Osho, The Dhammapada, The Way of the Buddha, Volume 8, Discourse Number 8.
The first question. Bhagwan, whenever you come to the absurd, something inside simply explodes and the whole world looks anew. Is it when the absurd becomes overwhelming that you get an insight into the gestalt of everything? Prem Prabhati, the absurd is nothing but another name of God, and a far more beautiful name than God itself. Because for centuries, the theologians, the philosophers, have destroyed the beauty of the word God. They have painted it, polished it with such rational garbage that it has no more any life left in it. The God of the philosophers is not the true God, because it is nothing but a rational concept. But the God of the lovers is a totally different phenomenon. It has nothing to do with reason, with mind. It is the heart pulsating in tune with the whole. It is a song, a symphony. It is a dance, a celebration. It is more poetry than prose. It is more intuitive than intellectual. It is something felt, not thought. Hence I say the absurd is a far better name for God. The mind has created a subtle structure around itself of rationality to protect the ego, to protect the separation from existence. All rationality is man-made, and God is not man-made. All rationality is just a projection of our own ideas on the screen of existence, and God is not a projection, it is a discovery. To see God, one needs eyes absolutely without any idea. The idea is the greatest cloud. One of the greatest mystics of the West, whose name is not known because he has not signed his book, this unknown mystic has written one of the most important mystic treatises ever, The Cloud of Unknowing. He says it is not through knowledge that you come to know. On the contrary, you come to know by unknowing. This is pure absurdity. It is talking in paradoxes, knowing through unknowing. What does he mean? He means when all knowledge has been dropped, when all experience has been put aside, when mind as such is no more functioning, then you relate with existence in a totally new way. Each fiber of your being pulsates with the whole. It is a rhythmic dance. It is absurd. You cannot make a theory out of it. God is not a hypothesis. If God is a hypothesis, then that hypothesis is no more needed. Far better hypotheses have been proposed by science. But God has never been a hypothesis. It is a passionate love affair with existence. It is feeling the existence. It is being in a heart-to-heart contact with existence. Tertullian is always worth remembering. A great Christian mystic. He says, I believe in God because God is absurd. Credo qua absurdum est. The reason that he gives for his belief is that there is no reason to believe. Unless you have something in your life which cannot be supported by reason at all, your life will not have any significance. Unless you have something for which you can live and for which you can die without any rational grounds, you will go on missing the very meaning of life and existence. You will remain superficial. Hence the absurd can release something tremendous in you. It can become an explosion. It can make you see the whole world anew, because it is a rebirth. You slip out of the mind. You are no more covered by the dust of the mind. Everything is fresh and new then. It is mind which makes things old. Because of memory, past, the mind goes on interpreting everything new in terms of the old. Mind cannot do otherwise. Mind means memory. Memory and nothing else. It is your accumulated past experience. And you go on interpreting the new according to the past. Naturally, the past gives its color to the new. It gives its meaning to the new. And the new is missed. That's why the whole world looks so boorish, utterly boorish. Existentialists have brought this situation of boredom as one of the most significant points to be pondered over. They say that man is utterly bored, and they are right. Only stupid people are not bored. Our Buddhas are not bored. Stupid people are not bored because they don't have that much sensibility, that much sensitiveness to feel boredom. And Buddhas are not bored because they don't carry the past. Everything is so fresh, so new. Everything is such a surprise. Every moment you are in for a surprise. For a Buddha, life is a continuous revelation, unending revelation. There is no beginning to it and no end to it. It is a mystery, unfathomable, immeasurable, unknown, and not only unknown but unknowable too. You can only taste it, feel it, see it, touch it, but you cannot know it. You cannot reduce it into a theorem, into a hypothesis. That is not possible. Prabhati, you are right. If you can have a contact with the absurdity of it all, with the irrationality of existence, you are moving into a totally different dimension. Moving from mind to no mind, moving from mind to meditation. That's what meditation is all about. Taking you out of the prison of the mind, prison of the past. And there is no other prison. The past is the only prison. The man of awareness, the meditator, goes on dying every moment to the past so that he remains new, fresh, childlike. Yes, if the absurd becomes overwhelming, you will have your first insight into the gestalt of everything. But remember again, the insight will not be rational. You will not be able to explain it away. You will not be able to say anything about it. You will be able to see, but suddenly you will become dumb. Suddenly you will find language absolutely inadequate, words impotent. Communication is not possible. Then only communion remains. When you know without knowledge, the only way to convey the message is through silence, through love, through compassion, through being. You can hold the hand of your friend and something may transpire. You can embrace your friend and something may transpire. You can just look into the eyes of your friend and something may transpire. The absurd can only be expressed through absurd ways. You can dance or you can sing. There is a beautiful story of a Baul mystic. A very rich man, a goldsmith, came to see the mystic and he asked about God. Do you believe in God? Is there really a God? Does God exist? The Baul mystic listened to all his queries, smiling, and then he started dancing, playing on his ikhtara, one stringed instrument. He started dancing. The goldsmith said, "Are you mad or something? I am asking great metaphysical questions. Rather than answering me, you start dancing. Are you drunk?" And the mystic said, "That's true. I am drunk. Drunk with the divine." But please don't misunderstand me. Don't feel offended. This is the only way I can answer your questions. And he sang a song of tremendous beauty and meaning and insight. He said, "I know that you are a goldsmith. I know that you can judge whether something is made of real gold or not. You have a touchstone on which it can be judged, but the touchstone will be absolutely useless if you come into the garden and start judging roses on your touchstone. For the gold it is okay, but for the roses it is not at all relevant. Roses cannot be judged on the touchstone on which gold can be judged. You can't know through the touchstone whether the roses are true or not true. For that you will need a totally different kind of approach. I know that you have studied much. You are very much interested in philosophical reasoning, argumentation. I have heard about you. But all that reasoning is as absurd here as the touchstone of the goldsmith will be in the garden. I am singing, I am dancing, I am playing music. Feel it. If you can dance with me, come on, dance with me. That may give you some insight into the world where I live. That may give you a touch of the unknown. There is no other way. I cannot logically answer your questions. Hence my illogical act. When Bodhidharma, the great Hindu mystic, reached China, the emperor of China had come to welcome him on the border with thousands of people. He had come to receive the great mystic, but he felt very embarrassed seeing Bodhidharma. He had never thought, he could have never imagined that Bodhidharma will enter China in such an insane way. Bodhidharma was carrying one of his shoes on his head. One shoe in one feet, the other feet bare, and the other shoe on his head. The king asked, "I don't understand. Why are you carrying one shoe on your head? Shoes are not meant to be carried on the head." Bodhidharma said, "This is the beginning. If you cannot understand this, then it is better I should go back." You have to understand one thing absolutely, that my approach is absurd. This is just to give an indication of my approach, that I am not a philosopher. You can call me a madman, but I am not a philosopher. And I am going to put things upside down. All that you have thought up to now, I am going to disturb it. I will bring a chaos into your being, because only out of chaos stars are born. It is very difficult to drop reason because one feels frightened. Reason gives you a sense of order. Reason gone, there is only chaos. But remember, reason is barren. That chaos is a womb. Out of that chaos, something of tremendous importance is born. You are reborn. Yes, if the absurd can overwhelm you, you will have an insight into the gestalt of everything, an insight which is untransferable, an insight which is inexpressible. But there are ways beyond words through which it can be communicated. That's the whole secret of the relationship of a master to a disciple. It is an absurd phenomenon. That's why the West has not known it yet. The West knows the relationship between a teacher and a student. It knows nothing of the relationship between a master and a disciple. The West is absolutely unaware of that dimension. That's why Jesus could not be understood. Socrates could not be understood. In the East, crucifying a Buddha has not been our practice. Are giving poison to Lao Tzu has not been our way. Why Jesus, Socrates, Mansur are killed? For the simple reason, they were trying to bring something absolutely Eastern to the West. They were trying to bring a new insight into God, and the time was not ripe. Maybe now the time is ripe. Jesus came a little earlier. Now the time is ripe. Now the West has the possibility to open up a new door, the absurd, and enter through that door. That is the only door to the temple of God. The second question, Bhagwan, old habits die hard. Prem Harideva, it is true. But why? Why old habits die hard? Because you are nothing but your old habits. If they die, you will die. You don't have anything more. You don't have anything plus. You are just your old habits, old patterns. You are a mechanism, not yet a man. That's why old habits die hard. It is very rare that a man exists. Very few and far in between. A Buddha is a real man, authentic. A Zarathustra is a real man. A man worth calling man. The ordinary humanity is just robot-like. It lives unconsciously. It lives mechanically. And habits are all that you have. If you drop all your habits, you will simply start evaporating. You will not find yourself at all. What you are. Just watch and you will find a bundle of old habits. You don't have yet anything more. That's the whole effort of meditation, to bring something more to your life which is not a habit. Something which is spontaneous, something which is non-mechanical, something which transforms you from a robot into a conscious being. George Gurdjieff used to say that every man is not born with his soul. On the surface it appears not believable, because for centuries you have been told by the priests that everybody is born with his soul, and you believe in it. It is comfortable to believe that you have a soul. It feels very good, cozy, warm, that deep inside you, you have a soul, eternal, immortal. And Gurdjieff says you don't have a soul at all. You are just hollow within. There is nothing inside you. Just habits and habits, a cluster of habits, and at the very center there is nobody. The house is empty. The master has not yet come or is fast asleep. And Gurdjieff is right. You are only potentially a human being. A possibility is there. But the possibility can be easily missed. and millions of people miss it. Because to become conscious, to become a soul, arduous effort is needed. It is an uphill task. To remain in your habits is cheap, easy, downhill. Gravitation is enough. It goes on pulling you. It is like when you are coming downhill in a car. You put the engine off. You don't need any gas for coming downhill. The pull of gravitation is enough. But that cannot be done when you are moving uphill. Then gas will be needed. You will need some integrity, some power. And only consciousness releases power. Consciousness is the key, the ignition key that releases power in you. And you become capable of soaring high. Otherwise, Harideva, this old saying is right, old habits die hard, because there is nobody who can kill those old habits. At breakfast, Finberg's wife told him, "We are having Sonia's boyfriend to dinner for the first time. We are gonna have a big meal with our best dishes, so please behave. Don't eat with your knife, or you will kill her chance for marriage." That night at supper all went well. Finberg hardly touched a thing for fear of using the wrong tool. Then coffee arrived. Finberg took the cup and started to pour his java into the saucer. The family was looking daggers at him. Finberg kept right on pouring. Finally, the saucer was full. Finberg raised it to his mouth, looked around the table and said, "One word out of any of you and I will make bubbles." It is difficult. It is very harsh. You have to be conscious, alert, on guard. You have to go on remembering. And remembrance is the most difficult thing in existence. Habits can be dropped, not by fighting against them. That's what people ordinarily do. If they want to change a habit, they create another habit against it, to fight with it. They move from one habit into another habit. If you want to drop smoking, you start chewing gum. Now it is as foolish as the other. You change one habit for another, but you remain the same unconscious person. To drop the habit and not to compensate for it, and to remain utterly aware and alert, so that you don't start moving into another substitute, is one of the hardest things in life. But it is not impossible. Otherwise, there will be no possibility of a Buddha, of a Christ, of a Krishna. Because Buddhas happen, it is possible. Difficult, very difficult, a great challenge has to be accepted. And all those who have any respect for themselves always accept the challenge of the greatest, the hardest thing. To reach to the moon is not so hard. It is not so difficult. To go to the Everest is a child's play compared with remembering constantly what you are doing, being aware. But the day awareness starts happening, you know the ecstasy of being, the bliss of being. You know something which cannot be imagined. It is so vast. It is so inexhaustible. Es dhammo sanantano. Buddha says it is the ultimate law of bliss, of joy, of ecstasy. And it is inexhaustible. Once you enter into it, it is forever yours. Jesus calls it the kingdom of God. That is his expression for it. But one has to become alert enough, aware enough, so that one can disidentify oneself with the habits, with the patterns, structures that have become ingrained in your being. This very rich but very miserly old man is dying. So he calls to his deathbed three men of the cloth, a rabbi, a priest, and a minister. When they arrive, he says, "Gentlemen, you know the old saying, you can't take it with you. Well, taking it with me is precisely what I propose to do. And because of your religious backgrounds, I feel I can trust you. Here in these three boxes is the greater part of all my wealth. My dying wish is that each of you places one box in my grave." All three agree to his request, upon which the dying man distributes the boxes and dies. Sure enough, on the day of the funeral, they all show up and each places a box in the grave. Later on, they decide to go to a nearby pub for a drink, where, after a long silence, the priest at last speaks. "Friends," says the priest, "I am afraid I have a confession to make. I did not put all the money in the grave. What with contributions falling off lately and the church in need of repair, it seemed such a sin not to put some of the money where it will do some good." Then the minister says, "Father, I am glad you spoke up. As you know, I am the head of several charities, and likewise it seemed to me such a sin to just bury all that money, so I too kept some of it, of course a small portion, to help these very worthwhile and needy charities of mine." After another long silence, the priest and the minister ask the rabbi, who has been looking out the window all this time, what he thinks about their actions. "Well," says the rabbi, "I must say that I am deeply surprised, not to mention shocked. As a rabbi, respecting the wishes of a dying man, I could only put in the full amount. In fact, I gave him my own personal check. A Jew is a Jew. Whether he is a rabbi or not does not make much difference. Old habits die hard, but they can die, and you have to make all the efforts so that they die, because in their death is the beginning of your real life. The third question, Bhagwan, is Indian government really so lousy as you were saying the other day? Pradeepama, it is not really the question of Indian government. Basically, it is the Indian mind. Indian mind is lousy. Indian government is only an expression of the Indian mind. And because the Indian mind is lousy, whatsoever it does becomes lousy. For centuries, the Indian mind has lived in this state. There is a reason to it. Why it has happened? The West is not so lousy. There is a reason to that too. Three religions were born out of India: Judaism, Christianity, Islam. They are all really offshoots of Judaism. Judaism is the source of them all. Three great religions were born in India: Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism. They are also offshoots of Hinduism. So in fact, in the world there are only two basic religions: Judaism and Hinduism. And the one basic difference between them is that Judaism believes in one life and Hinduism believes in many lives, in reincarnation. That has made the whole difference. If there is only one life, you have to be in a hurry. You have to do everything quick. And you have to do everything skillfully. So you need not do it again, because time is short. In the West, time is money. Because time is so short, 70, 80 years, half of it will be simply wasted in sleep. Most of it will be wasted in earning bread and butter. The remaining in looking at the TV. What is left for you? Hence there is a great hurry in the West and a great longing for speed. Without ever thinking, where are you going? Everybody is going. The only question is, one should go fast. Who cares where? Because who has time to bother about where? The only question is, with what speed are you going? I have heard one aeroplane was lost in the clouds. Its many sophisticated machines were not working, and the pilot on the telecom informed the passengers, "Don't be worried. There is bad news and there is good news too. The bad news first, that we don't know where we are going. The good news, that we are going with such beautiful speed that you need not worry." The speed is perfect. In the East, Hinduism introduced the idea of reincarnation. Many, many lives, millions of lives. Time is more than you need. It is not money at all. Then there is no question of hurry, no question of speech, no question of being skillful. You can do the same thing again and again. You can sleep and let the time pass. If this life goes down the drain, there is nothing to worry. There will be another life and another, and so on and so forth. These two ideas have created two different kind of people on the earth, the Western mind and the Eastern mind. These both ideas were created for a different reason. But when things reach to the unconscious man, he changes them according to his unconsciousness. Both are beautiful ideas, can be of tremendous importance. The idea that there is only one life means that don't waste it in unnecessary things. Don't waste it in accumulating money, gadgets. Don't waste it in superficial things. Think of the essential, not of the accidental. That was the message behind it. But what happened? People turned it completely upside down. They became much more interested in the non-essential, because there is not much time. So eat, drink and be merry. You are not going to be born again. So have as much as you can have of this world. That's what happened in the West. The idea was to make you a seeker for the essential. But it was transformed into its very opposite. It became eat, drink and be merry. Because soon you will not be here and you will not be coming again. Who knows about the other world, and who knows about God, and who knows about heaven? Don't be bothered with such nonsense, such esoteric nonsense. You be simple and enjoy this life as much as you can. Live it. Excuse every moment to your heart's content. That's what became of the great idea that was given by Abraham and Moses to the West. And in the East, the idea that there are millions of lives had also a tremendously significant message. It was to remind you that you have lived many, many times in the same rotten way. You have been moving in a wheel. You have been going in circles. Are you not bored yet? Are you not fed up yet? Are you so stupid that you can't see the utter futility of it all? Living for so many lives, desiring the same things, succeeding and failing and dying every time, have you not become aware that something else is needed? This world won't do. You have to transcend it. This was the idea behind Patanjali, Mahavira, Krishna, Buddha and their message. Reincarnation simply means be bored with the whole idea of desiring this and that. Be finished with it. Jump out of this wheel of life and death. But what really happened was totally different, just the opposite. What happened was India became very lousy, slow. The unconscious mind interpreted the whole message that there is no need to be in a hurry. There are many, many lives, so why worry? We will think of God in the old age or in the next life. There is no shortage of time. So go slow. East has not moving at all. It is stuck. It has become undynamic, dormant, stagnant. This is one of the great calamities that happens always. Whenever a conscious man gives you a certain strategy, a certain idea to help you, you change it according to your mind, and rather than using it as a help, it becomes a harmful thing for you. You are given nectar by the Buddhas. By the time it reaches you, it becomes poison. So it is not really the question of Indian government. Indian government is only an expression of Indian mind. The Indian mind needs a change, just as the Western mind needs a change. Both have gone wrong. I have no preference for either. Both have created misery for humanity up to now. We need a new mind which will not be either Western or Eastern. A new global mind. For the first time, universal mind is needed. And for the first time we need a man who thinks not in terms of nations, hemispheres, races, blood, colors, religions, but who thinks only in terms of consciousness. We need to raise the consciousness of whole humanity. India suffers from great lousiness. A guy dies and goes straight up to paradise. Saint Peter stops him at the gate and says, "Sorry, sir, but you can't come in. You are not registered in the paradise list. You have to go to hell. But as you were not so bad, you can choose between the Indian hell or the German hell. Well, says the guy, before choosing, I would like to know what the difference is. Okay, I will explain, says Peter. The Indian hell is a swimming pool full of shit. And you stand in it with shit right above your head. And each time you try to put your head out of the shit, there is a guard who hits you on the head with his stick till you go back under. And what about the German hell? Asked the guy. The German hell is a swimming pool full of shit. And you stand in it with shit above your head. And each time you try to get out, there is a guard who hits you on the head with his stick. So, says the guy, I don't see much difference. You know what? Says Peter. As I am feeling pretty far out today, I will tell you something. In the Indian hell, there is sometimes not enough shit. Or the guard is not there. Or he forgets his stick. The fourth question. Bhagwan, do you think it is possible to measure love and life in percentages as you did in the lecture the other day? Michelle, what other day? I have completely forgotten. My memory is not very good. Harvey was traveling east by train to a business convention in New Orleans. On the train, he happened to read an article in the Reader's Digest about a 75-year-old American Indian from Arizona who was reported to have the longest memory in the world. Since the train was passing within a few miles of this famous Indian, Harvey decided to stop and visit him. Sure enough, he was directed to a large teepee in the middle of an Indian reservation. Inside the teepee, an old wrinkled man was sitting cross-legged, smoking a pipe. After exchanging a few formalities, Harvey asked, "What did you have for breakfast on December 11th, 1908?" The Indian crossed his hands over his chest and grunted, "Eggs." Harvey was immensely impressed and left to catch his train. 10 years later, while traveling through Arizona, Harvey decided to stop and see if the old Indian was still alive. Sure enough, he was led to the same teepee, but was cautioned to enter very slowly, as the old man was very old and must not be startled. Once inside, Harvey raised up one hand and greeted in friendly Indian style, "How?" Upon which the old Indian grunted, "Scrambled." Now, I don't have that type of memory. Michelle, what can I say today? I will say, I don't know about the other day. Love and life cannot be measured. in percentages. Nothing can be measured, in fact, because the whole is one and immeasurable. But for certain purposes, it is possible to use the method of measurement. But that is only for certain purposes. For example, life cannot be measured, but this can be said, that life exists only between a certain range of temperature, from 98 degrees to 110. Only 12 degrees. Beyond 110 and you are finished. Fall below the normal and you start slipping. So just 12-15 degrees is fine. For a certain purpose, for a medical purpose, that's perfectly true. Life cannot be measured if you think of consciousness. But if you think of the mind, it can be measured. Your mind is nothing but a biocomputer. And sooner or later, computers will be doing better than your mind. It is possible, even in your life, because by the end of this century, robots will be walking on the roads. And they will look exactly like you. And many times, you will be in trouble. You may think that the man is real, or the woman is real. And the woman or the man may be just a robot. Now scientists are thinking to cover the mechanism of the robot with artificial synthetic skin. And they will grow hairs. And they will behave exactly like you. Only once in a while you will suspect that something is wrong. When their battery will go down. Then grrr, grrr, grrr. Otherwise they will be perfectly okay. Just a moment before, the woman was hugging you and saying, "I love you." And now she says, "Grrr, grrr." The only difference will be known when the person will fall ill. The real one will go to the hospital and the robot will go to the factory, to the garage. Then you will know the difference. Otherwise, there will be no possibility to know the difference. In fact, the ordinary man is already nothing but a robot. Your unconscious life can be measured in percentages. And your love can also be measured in percentages. Because what love you have, it is nothing but chemistry. Yes, the love of a Christ or a Buddha is immeasurable, because it is transcendental to the hormones, to the chemistry, to the physiology. But your love is hormonal. Just give an injection of strong hormones and great love arises in you. Take few hormones out of you and flat on the ground. All love disappears. Your love can be measured, but it is not love. It is just a biological urge. And your life is a chemical phenomenon. But there is a life behind your life, and there is a love above your love that is immeasurable. but neither my memory is very good, nor my mathematics is very good. Kiloran was considered by most of the villagers to be the dumbest man in the town. One day he showed up in new clothes and began buying rounds of drinks at the neighborhood saloon. The neighbors wondered what had happened. When one of them finally asked him, Kiloran replied, "I won the first prize in a big lottery." "How did you ever guess the lucky number?" "Well, three times running I dreamed of 7. So I figured it out that 3 times 7 is 24. And I bought ticket number 24 and it won." "Why, you fool, 3 times 7 is 21, not 24. "You have got the education," said Kiloran. "I have got the lottery money." And Michel, that's what I would like to say to you. You may know mathematics, you have got the education, I have got the lottery money. Question. Bhagwan, I have heard that married men live longer than the unmarried. Is it so? Satyadeva, meditate over Murphy's maxim. Married men don't really live longer. It only seems that way. And Satyadeva, why you are worried? I think you must be beyond 60 now. Are you thinking to get married? To live longer? It is time to think of something else. Time to think of death, not of marriage. Time to think of the eternal, not the longer. Even if you live 70, 80, 90, what does it matter? What you will do? If you live 90 or 100 years, you will do the same stupidities again and again. What you have been doing up to now for these 60 years, you will do the same things, even if you are given 60 years more. Think of something new. And death is bound to come. When you die is not important. Death is absolutely certain. That is important. After birth, only one thing is certain in life, and that is death. Everything else is uncertain. Don't try to escape death. Don't try to avoid it. For centuries, people have been trying all kinds of ways to avoid death. But death comes all the same. Whether married or unmarried, it doesn't matter. You will die. You are dying. In fact, death does not come one day suddenly. It starts the day you are born. You start dying from the very first breath. Your each birthday is a death day. Your life is slipping out of your hands, and you cannot escape. An ancient Sufi parable. A rich merchant in Baghdad sent his servant one day to the marketplace to buy food. But after a few minutes, the servant returned, looking panic-stricken. "Master," he cried, "you must lend me your best horse immediately, so that I may flee to Damascus and thereby escape my fate." "Whatever is the matter?" asked the merchant. "I went to the marketplace and I saw death standing there among the stallholders," exclaimed the servant. "He made a hostile gesture at me and started walking towards me. I beg you, lend me your best horse so that I may flee to Damascus and escape." The merchant was a kind man, and he did as his servant asked. Then he himself walked down to the marketplace to see if the story was true. Sure enough, death was standing in the crowd. "Why did you make a hostile gesture at my servant?" asked the merchant. "I made no gesture of hostility," replied death. I was simply very surprised to see him, for I have an appointment with him tonight in Damascus." You cannot escape. Wherever you go, you will find your death waiting for you. Yes, it can be prolonged, postponed. But what is the point? Rather than postponing, why not use this opportunity of becoming aware of death, that it is approaching, that it is on the way, that any moment you will be in its grip? Don't ask for the horse, and don't try to go to Damascus. You cannot escape. The only way is to transcend, not to escape. You ask me, I have heard that married men live longer than the unmarried. Is it so? If it is so, then what? Will you get married? At the age of 60, it will be so stupid. A man of 20 can be forgiven, but you cannot be forgiven. Mr. Goldberg visited the doctor's office complaining that he had flying crabs. A lab test was taken, and Mr. Goldberg anxiously waited while the doctor, with a sad look, came to give him the report. "I am sorry, Mr. Goldberg," he said, "but those flying crabs we thought you had, well, they turned out to be fruit flies. I am sorry, but your banana is dead." Enough for today.